Nancy Esposito's most recent book is Lamentation with Junebug. Her first book of poems was Changing Hands. Mem Rain was a winner of the National Looking Glass Poetry Chapbook Competition, published in 2002 by Pudding House Publications, which also published Greatest Hits 1978 to 2001 and 2003. She received the Discovery the Nation Award, Massachusetts Arts Lottery Grant, the Colliday Award, PSA Award, a Fulbright Grant to Egypt, and grants to Southeast Asia, as well as an NEH to study the Vietnam War. Her own work has been translated into Spanish and Vietnamese. She has been published in numerous magazines, among which are American Poetry Review, The Nation, and Three Penny Review. It's quite a list. We're very happy to have Nancy Esposito.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, and thank you for coming. I'm going to start with a new poem, which is really kind of silly, but I need to read it because it's an exorcism. The title is At First Bite. I have never been so loved as the summer I pastured next to the Phragmites, waving left, then right, like Metropolitan Opera groupies applauding Jonas Kaufmann. I thought I might tire of such affection. This clearly wasn't lust, though maybe a female-to-female drinking problem that caused an irrepressible fixation on my type O blood every time I breathed out my own precious CO2. What lingers is desire to stretch my hands over my body and scratch the welts of passion until they bleed and bleed and scab over until the next year's vernal equinox. And I'm going to read three from Lamentation with Junebug. Junebug is the southern scarab, and a lot of these poems take place in the South. I was born in Texas, long family history in Texas. And a lot of this book is about my mother. So I'm going to start with a poem that sort of prefaces the rest of the book. And it's dedicated to Primo Levi. All of you must know who he was. And I guess I want to say that I associate a Buddhist koan with him, that I have a meditation practice, and one of the things I always do is ask, can I love this? And I ask it of everything, all the most terrible things, like our government. Chemical examination. We have left the landing, have closed our doors. Sit behind them like betrayed lovers, counting out what we misrepresented, mistranslated, what we failed to love, how we loved without letting go. This next poem is based on Milan Kundera's book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which for many years I read once a year. Sometimes I still do. And interestingly, I don't own it. So weird. I should also say that there's mention of a man named Floyd Collins, who in 1925, he was a spelunker and was walking all the caves of Kentucky and died on this walk. And then, can't read my own. Oh, there's one part where it goes into some Spanish and it starts with tiene mierda. And it's all awful language, which I'm not going to bother to translate. You'll get it. A student of physics. Last night I looked in the mirror, saw scaffolding crawling skyward from the cobble of old Rome, each sagging structure repentant of the allure below. Saw Newton's law reconstructing the human face. Vertigo, according to Kundera, is compelled by desire. Is compelled by desire to, rather than fear of, plummeting toward emptiness, which Floyd Collins must have intuited on that crystalline Kentucky morning, January 1925, when his longing for unspoiled mineral light poured itself down a shaft toward the illusion of cave. By a mistake of judgment and rock, the comic shape of leg of lamb, he jammed his foot. After backhoes and hoists and sandwiches and bets and day after day, they got to him late, a stalagmite of skeleton jutting toward light. From the Namib Desert, where nothing hides, and the heat licks white the bones of stragglers, you write that your love tiene mierda, egoismo, tacos, tripas, y mala hostia, ranged against the arid sky as though it were Vermont, the aurora borealis over my head, the solid shape of color before it is attracted toward me in free fall. This language will not do for dizziness, nosedive, or the probability formula for randomness, synonym to all our passions. Love, for instance, isn't a transitive verb, but the relative antecedent into which I fall, were I compelled to, freely, as into the bioluminescence of Pyridinium barmense, flicking on and off in the Caribbean dark. Don't know where my voice is.
Some water, Nancy?
I have some, but it's in my car. Thank you. And one more from this book. Oh, thank you. Remind me not to eat dinner before I read.
You might have a different problem.
Okay. As I said, this book is a lot about my mother. My mother died of dementia, but the vascular kind, not Alzheimer's. And there is mention of El Rosario in Mexico, where the monarchs go to winter over. Out of mind. She needs help, she says. A mess, she says. And will I call the lawyer, arrange the divorce? From whom, my father long dead, I ask, not recognizing the edge dweller between jungle and savannah my mother's mind has become, desert nomad trekking out of her own story, or giving legs to dream space where desire hatches, fledges, anxiety stalks in heavy sand, where this poem incubates. The pier and beam arthritic, the rib cage of rooms caved inward. She owns the lake and surround, a tributary of the Trinity, cotton fields to the south, oil derricks like her father's lamps to the east, a valley in Big Bend and every live oak gardened on the wind. This is the alternate life, the tenebrous, the conjurer's life who saws her mind in two, pulls from it a nameless man, unwitting as a rabbit, a philanthropist like her grandfather. Moths rise from the wool carpeting, chimerical as autobiography. The hot July day, she retired her teeth, the golden oak door locked behind her. And like Alice, she stumbled into inversions, her bed and chair overstuffed into a room that no longer gives onto mulberry trees and mute swans. A wall, nettle, a strand of awful ivy. Nice people, she says, in this hotel. Her daughter changes the non-existent subject. The only difference is knowing the difference, a virgule between the lie or dream and the phantasmagoria that adds up to an ordinary life. Her mind, a homeless thing, sheltering in any unlocked image, like any artist, marginal, a maker of what has never before existed until the moment when to make is past and participial. Spectacular salmon pink of the ore gold Rio Samba rose. One evening on the bank of the Charles, I adopted the third instar of a caterpillar, circled on the velvet belly of a milkweed leaf. I nurtured him through adolescence until the morning he shed his boyhood and from his glass house emerged full monarch of the air. Out of sight, carried on thermals to El Rosario, maybe, where he, I'm positive, lit an Oyamel fir by night, by day, nectared in fields of echinacea and dogbane, a cosmos beneath him, immense, proprietary, beyond me. This little book, Memrain, means same rain. I spent about 2 years in Latin America, some of it in Mexico and some of it in Nicaragua. And because Nicaragua, I was there during the revolution and lived in Managua. And because it's all happening again and it's in the news every day, I decided to read a couple of poems from this. The first I'll read, this was a full-length edition that I cut down for this chapbook contest and won it. So now I'm a little sad that I didn't keep it all together in one big volume. Never mind. The first one is called Explosion at the Military Hospital, Managua. Mangoes burst on the laminated roof and wake me up into what could be the war, blackened into headline each morning, the end of the long, tense wait. But even as I feel it is, I know it isn't. The fire backlighting the bare limbs of the ceiba between the patio and the dry hill now rejuvenated in a foot race of flames to the top. It's a good movie, large screen, money spent to put on this battle scene, I say, as the family arms the flashlights with new batteries, hoses water into barrels and every tub. The voice of the nation plays salsa, pauses urgent, todo bien, doctors to their posts, more beating of guitar and gourd, the beans enclosed crackling like shattering glass. A neighbor signs the cross, her eyes invested in the semiotics of a star. I put my mind to her memories of drapery, closed to the trembling and the whining all night as tonight, of ambulances transferring patients. As I stand in my nightgown over blue jeans, wearing a fever now 3 weeks, put my arm around the mother and think of the doctor, put off by countless swans in the poetry of Darío. Think of the doctor who's never called, like the old friend, or the new who's forgotten to tell me she's back from the sea. Think how I've chewed a week of dinners without a sentence of rest, the lover preferring no one to come between his interests and himself. A maverick, this fire, I think. My hand blanches from the ash lacing a mango I stoop to recover, and my life while I wait for the word. I also lived in the home of a terrorist from Italy. There's no reciprocity between Italy and Nicaragua, so he still lives in Managua. His wife and children were there at the time when I lived in their house. He is still probably a pediatrician. And he was part of the Alberto Moro killing in Italy. Terrorist. Dots line up, lie down on newsprint. Lay a grid of skull. The classic features of the man, his mustache, wire-rim glasses over his hunted eyes. Gray becomes him, and all there is to a life decomposed into story, until he moves out of his frame, on the page to live in the spectra of any single day that begins with a taken name and shower, a bowl of coffee uncompromised but by three pale biscuits. He helmets his features, snakes a stethoscope into a pocket, then sits his motorcycle for the ride to danger every day as sewage, lambent in ruts along the packed earth where the poor quarter their diseases, and believe he clears the place with the timing of explosives in a commuter's terminal. Returned by afternoon to a rented house with red tile floors, to his wife whose laugh shatters his day dream, kidnaps him from home, a language away in another country where snow comforts his garden. Here there's a filigree of parsley, durable as the stock of a shotgun, and in a ditch, red and white impatience, waiting for burial, his hands cupping the soil as though it were a fledgling tumbled from its nest. Or his boy and girl, catapulted mid-air to a hammock, rocking near the pigeon's roost. As he, from that continent to this, his anger stunning as an oracle against the bad habits of giving in or up. The two children again ask to be cupped in his hands, again to be risked in flight, so guarded by his passion that even surrendered, unresisting, no story will ever have captured it, no poem. This, the title of this is I Am Church, and it's what Pat Farrell, the leader of the American Nuns for Reform, said when she was asked about what her reform movement meant, getting women into the Catholic Church, into the clergy and all. And she said, I am church. And I began thinking about how we use I am, what comes after that, how many times we say that in a day in our lives. And then also I had been reading The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert. So you'll get the combination, I think. I am church. I am Wiccan. I am cult between buttes, maybe cotton fields. I am belly of beast, not beast. I am some body's placenta. I am somebody. I am game, no players. I am chess king without court. I am court heart. I am cattail. I am dogtooth. I am toucan beak, warbler wing, grackle eye. I am brittle star, eyeless. I am word weaver, word terminator. I am mind on the loose, twisted tongue. I am unintended consequence. I am aleatory contract. I am colluvial fan. I am asteroid, Cretaceous clay in Gubbio. I was Panama's golden frog. I am age, geological, phoenixed, existence and extinction. I am Anthropocene rat, larger than a kangaroo. I am consequence, a somebody. I am nobody, inconsequence, no body. And this just got rejected after 7 months by the New Yorker. I won't go into my song and dance about this poem because it's about, 20 minutes to tell you.
You don't have a two-minute version?
Hmm?
You don't have a two-minute version?
To tell you about it?
Yeah.
It's a persona poem. I read it in a Southern accent. It's about an evangelical snake charmer. And, who charms snakes and is not harmed because Jesus is protecting her, right? Okay. I grew up in Texas. There were a lot of holy rollers in Texas with tents that near the country club my family belonged to, so I used to try to sneak in. Anyway. But this poem is really about, I think, for me, about the way, clearly, the language we speak is changed, changes our outlook on everything. Just the vocabulary of any language. And I feel that way about the accent we speak in. I was living in Oxford, teaching at Oxford, UK, when I wrote this. And of course, listening to a British accent all the time. And I began to think how it shaped meaning in a way that my American accent didn't, and shapes language differently, meaning differently. And so I try to read this in a Southern accent because obviously the accent of this persona shapes meaning differently from reading in my own accent. So it's called Snake Charmer. But I can see you're not stunned enough. And it's the devil's work I see. You're accusing me. You're seeing my arms and legs branch off me like I was crisp as my snakes and muscular as rage. You're dying to inquire why a lady wants to risk her limbs if it's got nothing to do with divinity, like I should be that tree down in Eden folding its leaves in prayer to keep from getting its fruits swiped. Now, when I was a copper-headed little girl and always got put in red to match, I'd swing out back at the haunch of the old live oak and press my toes into the fig vine against Granddaddy's work shed, who called me the apple of his eye and laughed about me going to be the bad one in the bunch. That made sense to me, about as much as snakes being God's way of punishing generosity, like a birthday, minus the cake and presents. Especially since the first time I handled one like it was giving itself wrapped up to me and waiting to get opened. Just a tiny garter snake. But I knew that I was knowing what to do. It was like that for such a long time. I was almost sorry there weren't going to be any more secrets. And then, like I'd been struck by a poison dart, it landed on me that those others were the gifts saved for last. Not that I'd be drawn by anything evil, but the way I was seeing it, what's got danger lying insides got a subtlety going on. Maybe the slipknot of meanness, or something elastic as the heart, something tender and also tough with being scared to wobble it out. But those ones don't lie out on your back lawn and slither across your raised eyebrows like they were a satin bow come untied and streaming like a comet's tail in a once-in-your-lifetime's miracle. A surprise party is what it was. The first one that beat it around the big rock like it was his glassed-in front parlor. A rattler done up in all his bangles dancing for my warm blood. And then it was over. And I could have spread a picnic blanket and invited him for a sandwich and berries. Later and fast as dust devils, the hooded cobra spitting at me like he'd just learned the alphabet and corals like party favors, all yellow, black, and red. I can see I'm nuts in your eyes. But I'd like to set you at your ease as I've got no mind to belly out of here hanging my head. I suppose you might say I've come to cherish what nobody else allows and feel right at home with it, unlikely as it is to you, like this snake you see threaded round my calf, like a sheer stocking slipping into a shoe. Thank you.
Thank you, that was great.
Thank you.
Wendy Drexler's third poetry collection, Before There Was Before, was published by Iris Press in March 2017. A three-time Pushcart Prize nominee, she's also the author of Western Motel and the chapbook Drive-Ins, Gas Stations, and Bright Motels. Her poems have appeared widely in many journals and in the anthologies Blood to Remember, American Poets on the Holocaust, and Burning Bright, Passenger Celebrates 21 Years. Wendy's first children's book, Buzz, Ruby, and Their City Chicks, co-authored with Joan Fleiss Kaplan, was published by Ziggy Owl Press in 2016. Wendy grew up in Denver, Colorado, and now lives in Belmont, Mass. She is a freelance editor and has been poetry editor and a cavity nest monitor for the Massachusetts Audubon Society. She is currently a certified poet in residence at the Boston Public Schools.
Thanks so much for the introduction, and it's great to be here. Thank you for rescheduling us. It's much nicer to be here summer in October rather than winter in May. And Nancy, I think this is the first time we've actually read together.
Is that true?
I think so.
No, we have together.
We did. Oh, that's right. But there were like seven Belmont poets. Yeah. This is much more intimate and fun. So what a wonderful center, and thank you for keeping it going. I'm going to begin with a little about myself. This is called A Self-Portrait, and it was inspired by a poem of the same name by Adam Jagodziewski, and has an epigraph from his poem, Self-Portrait, which is "The life that, so far, belongs to me." I'm an only child, and I used to have an imaginary friend who lived on the ceiling. I love ceilings, woodwork, moldings, cornices, the cushions of the kitchen chairs in my childhood in Denver. They were naugahyde, the color of ripe tangerines. I walk through that house of glass, brick, and wood in my mind, stop at the hall mirror where I tried to watch stars. I come from a long line of stars. Phosphorus on my mother's side, free-moving on my father's, self-made on my stepfather's. I keep a journal of every book I've read, H is for Hawk, Peter Pan, Being Mortal. Avocados and the workmanship of the pit make me strong. I like knowing the chickadee by its call. Hey, sweetie, sweetie. But I don't really know much about chickadees. Purple's my favorite color. I'm wearing some purple now, I think. Yeah. I want to feel cozy with myself even when I'm late or stuck in traffic. After a long childhood of service tension and turbulence, I am both the fire and the firefighter. Anger is easier than love, I think, but love is what licks me clean, even though I'm always afraid of getting lost in the woods. The ocean's dangerous too, though I'm not afraid of it. I'm afraid for my country. And I've had a request from Elizabeth to read a poem from my previous book in the city of the cruise ship, Valor. So if I may grab one of these. Let's see where it is. 14. I went on one cruise. And so my son graduated from high school, and I knew he would just love it. And it was an experience. I think once was enough for me. The city of the cruise ship, Valor. I am a little god on vacation, entitled to gamble 5 nights in the Shogun Casino among brocade samurai and slot machines, the bell-ringing bets, the humanly frivolous cries. I overeat at the midnight dessert buffet beneath the tiled wall mural of Rosie the Riveter. I spend hours steeping in the whirlpool, arrange my pedicure, my aroma spa ocean wrap. Someone changes my linens, scrubs my toilet. Someone brings me pina coladas while I sun beside the pool, flashing my tattoo and my gold chain. I bought perfume and a leather wallet from the poor in every port and paid good money to kiss a dolphin. And if I buy the skin of the last blue iguana from a boy who follows me from stall to stall like a dog, am I not from the city of the ship? And if I'm seasick, I call my room steward to bring me Dramamine. She turns down my sheets, folds my towels into snakes on my bed, black dots where eyes should be. Forgive me. Okay, I'm going to read a few poems from my collection Before There Was Before, and this poem is a response to a quote from Carl Sagan. He poses the question, if there's nothing here but atoms. If there's nothing. Did Monet love light more than he loved Rouen Cathedral? Or did he need to stand long enough in the same place to see that nothing stays, even evening is eroding, the saints in the portal of the cathedral softening in each other's gaze. Even the dead refused to stay dead, and so Cerberus needed 3 heads to keep them from leaving the Shadow Kingdom. Yesterday, the pond was dazzled by the turquoise wings of dragonflies mating mid-air, the water lilies helixing. Everywhere I look is a pool of sensation. And in the morning, my brain begins to savor the coffee before my hand reaches the cup. Let's touch it all, call it home. This next poem is really an ode to a dead beetle that I found on my basement floor, and initially just cringed and went, ugh, and I took a Kleenex and I threw it in the trash, and then I said, Wendy, you better go take that out and take a look at it. And wrote this poem, Beetle. His black shellacked body lay belly up on the basement floor, everything in him already decided. The huge husk of him three sections knuckle-coupled like train cars, the abdomen scribed with scarabs, compact as a flower bowl, the thorax hinged to his tiny head. And inside that, the minuscule brain that mounted his little music, day and night issued meek and fierce instructions to himself in his dark city. And refused what? And raced where? Sought what solace scuttling? And did he notice or not the tepid light squinting through smeared windows? Did he brace his legs against the spin of the washer's thrum? Nothing more for him but this one hard look, to memorize the six matched dancers of his legs, each curving toward its partner in a series of jointed et ceteras all the way out to the hooks, barbed and beyond, the ardent tips that almost touch. I kind of like hanging out at Dunkin' Donuts. Just maybe it's the voyeur in me. I'm just fascinated by the people there and the whole ambiance. At Dunkin' Donuts, a man and a woman are talking close. He crumbles a muffin, takes a bite, bows his head over the styrofoam cup he's cradling in both hands, palms it side to side, gouges the lip with his thumbnail. Her red sweater glows like sunrise as she leans her head on his shoulder, smooths his forearm with the tips of her fingers, combs a crumb from his sleeve with the side of her hand, brushing away each undone, every undeliverable. And I want to pour them a pitcher of blue sky. Plant an apple tree between their arms, save his cup for my museum of what makes us human. The wear and tear of it, the coffee-stained too-muchness of it, that brush of touch that caresses an arm, a shoulder, that grace, that brace, that balm. And this is a love poem for my husband. We're celebrating our new patio furniture, the striped cushions that pick up the warm tones of the acacia wood table and chairs, the new umbrella, a special order from Bed Bath & Beyond, more than enough shade. We pour two glasses of wine, drink the late afternoon slant light, savor the clouds as soft as lambskin, the table oiled to a sheen. You say we should plant an apple tree at the bend in the road so we won't have to see the traffic. I tell you that the fox urine I bought at the hardware store and sprinkled on the flower bed hasn't stopped the rabbits from snapping off the daisies. I get up to rip out some swallowwort before it strangles the forsythia and think of the dead who have nothing to do while we fret in the garden. Take another sip of Malbec. Nibble goat cheese on a cracker, letting the good enough be. And I'm going to read some new poems, which is fun. There's several of these I've never read before, so I'll try them out. Well, last summer I found out that I have something in common with Angelina Jolie. Mm-hmm. We both had the BRCA gene mutation, which puts me at greatly increased risk of several types of cancer, breast, ovarian, pancreatic, which I have a family history of. So this is a poem called Talk Back with My BRCA Gene Mutation. And there's an epigraph from Lucy Brock Broido. I am obliged now to refrain from dying for as long as it is possible. All these years, you've been lying in wait, trying to kill me. I drive fast past the marsh, choked with loose strife, plunge in icy ocean to sting myself senseless, then stop to buy myself a double-dip soft serve at the drive-in where the counter girl swirls a spiral to the mound's flared tip. Chocolate oozes down. I crunch that cone to crumbs. same gene in me that seeded my mother's pancreas, Aunt Norma's pancreas, my grandmother's breast. Where are my border walls? Don't fondle me, don't beggar, don't guzzle sunset, don't ladder my ribs, don't tribal, don't Pied Piper my cells over a cliff. Take my ovaries, they're nothing to me now. But you can't have my breasts, shapeshifter, and keep your hands off my daughter. And as for Hannah, who lives in the present continuous, let her beat another little riff with me on her toy drum.
Angelina Jolie could never write like that.
Thank you, Jim. Barbara Streisand takes her two cloned dogs to visit their mother. I saw the Instagram photo on her website, Miss Violet in a lavender bandana, Miss Scarlet in red, on hind legs, their heads turned, peering over the top of their stroller. Streisand writes, "My little girls were looking at their mother pictured on her gravestone. Mother's face, a carved rondelle on the granite slab. It's all over the top. The dogs are small, white and fluffy, a breed I've never heard of, Coton de Tulliar. Just before Samantha died, a doctor scraped cells from her mouth and stomach. I read on TMZ that for $50,000 and change, I could have done that, brought back my first dog, Fella. I loved that black mutt. My mother named him after FDR's dog, Fella. I really miss my mother, too. Never got the chance to tell her I loved her. Come to think of it, I miss my child self, troubled as I was, my teenage years riddled with insecurity, my young married self full of Earth Day hope, my harried young mother self. I miss my two children when they were infants and I was sleep-deprived and pricked my thumbs on diaper pins. I miss my mother most of all. If I could have cloned her before she died, I might have raised her as my own."
What was the title of that?
Barbara Streisand takes her two clone dogs to visit their mother.
She came to Gloucester in a million-dollar RV with her husband a few years ago. Went camping.
Yeah, went camping? Oh, good for her. Did she bring her dogs? I wonder if anybody saw that. Oh, maybe it was just one then. Maybe it was just Samantha before she got the cloned. She actually wound up with, I think, three. I can't remember now. She's down to two, but... Yeah. a few months ago, I saw my ex-husband at a play at intermission, and he was like just in the row in front of me, and he didn't recognize me. This is called At Intermission. Unbelievable, yeah. I called out to him. It deserved a poem. I called out to him, my voice strong. "Hi, Jeff." He turned, stared. "I'm sorry," he said. "Do I know you?" I whispered, "You're kidding. It's me, Wendy." "Your hair looks so different," he said. And the wife I'd been those heavy years fell over me. And I wondered if I was to apologize for being different. I started joking then about my hair to relieve my shame or to relieve him of his, or for him to say, "My hair looked really good." Years ago, the Roma people used to keep dancing bears. They inserted metal rings through their noses, pulled the bears around by those rings. The bears had to stand up on their hind legs and dance for tourists. They weren't allowed to hibernate. When the bears were freed, years later to sanctuaries, they hibernated the first winter. Then they woke up and didn't know what to do. They began to stand up on two legs. They began to rock back and forth and side to side. They started to dance. Okay. This is a poem in memory of Irina Radushinskaya, whose obituary appeared in the New York Times July 15, 2017. poem for a Soviet dissident poet. Irina, I read your obituary, 4 brutal years in a gulag prison where you wrote your poems on a bar of soap with a burnt matchstick, memorized them, then washed your hands and your poems down the drain. Despite the freezing, the hunger, the forced labor, sharpening your mind on a matchstick. And what strength to write of the first beauty you saw in captivity, frost on a window. Only a blue radiance you wrote on a tiny pane of glass. I too see that adamance, that everything is attached to everything, the frost to the glass, oyster shells to a rock they can't be pried from, the moon to the sky, the ocean to its wave, your bar of soap to the burnt ash of the match, long enough. This next poem was inspired by a visit to Brooklyn to visit my daughter and granddaughter, Hannah. And it's like when I go to New York, just always something totally unexpected happens, and often it's kind of wonderful. But usually very surprising. Back among my own. It was dusk. It was dusk. I'd just come from the market with milk, hurrying home for our dinner, the Brooklyn street corner buzzing like a hive, when I nearly tripped over a telescope right there on the sidewalk, its giant eye tilted toward the moon. I stopped, marveling, moved closer, and a man gestured with open palm, "Have a look." I lowered my eye to the lens, which was as private as a peephole, peered down the tunnel, risque and mine alone to enter. I recoiled at the blast. There were craters close enough to swallow me, and where the waxing crescent curved away, it was like walking into the valley of the shadow of death. And the whiteness, stark and scarred, was blinding, a comfortless cold, all that light coming from the other side of the world where the sun hadn't yet set. That moon, I tell you, was dazzling and terrifying and desolate. Not one tree or garden or fountain, no bees or tigers or bodegas selling milk or cracked concrete cooling into the night. No cars or car radios blasting, no mercury or corroded lead pipes or any of the other things that are killing us or being killed by us. My God, that moon filled my every pore, and I dove into silence. And when I ripped away my eye, I was jolted by the shudder of air around my shoulders. People swirled by me, every shade of flesh, pink, nutmeg, chocolate, and I was caught like a fastball in the beautiful din and swell of strangers I was back among, my intimates, my very own sweet kind. And my final poem is a persona poem. It's called Moss Muse, and I was part of a collaboration with visual artists and poets at the Boston Sculptors Gallery this past summer, and was invited to participate by a wonderful fiber artist, Jody Colella, and we conceived a project together. We were both really fascinated by moss. So this is the work that I created. And I think this is probably as close to hip-hop as I will ever get. Moss Muse. We slid from inland ponds and algal strands once ozone made it safe to make our way to land. But we're not primitive, just down to earth, growing right under your feet in girths, clumps, fronds, tufts, and sheets. Wise and sly, we are discreet. Looking meek, we crawl and creep in the boundary layers, trapping heat and water vapor. And while we're small, that's not all. We've a genius for filling the emptiness, snatching a scant gap spreading between cracks. We can haul ourselves up a wall with no fall to roll and still leave our mark on logs, stumps, and bark. For a lark, some of us wheedle brides on backs of beetles. Everyone stomps on our backs, which only helps our rhizodes latch and attach. We've no need for seeds or fruits, or roots, flowers, or fruit. We adore opening our pores, throwing our spores to the wind, finding rapport in the shadiest out of the way. Our sex is complex. Some sperms swim to eggs on a single splash of water, but some are too slow or get stalled by the wall of a water droplet, so we've devised more ways to multiply. Some of us are celibate, propagate by cloning body parts, bulbils, brood bodies, branchlets, detach, disperse, immersed in new habitats. We have our pets, too, never neglecting the welter of invisible fauna to whom we give food and shelter, sharing our lairs with cuddly water bears, a load of rotifers, springtails with thintails, flowing nematodes, the delightful mite. Here's our secret to doing without. In times of drought, dried up and shriveled, we're not dead but dormant. And before we shut down, our genes will have written precise genetic instructions for our resurrection. For we know the ways of rain, the art of waiting, 100 years if we must, unflustered, gathering dust, packed tightly together, holding on to each other, until water, our goddess, bestows just one drop. In only seconds, we reckon, we revive, photosynthesize, thriving on proteins, restored to life and to luster, parading once more in the shade, our stock and trade, sipping dew and rising anew. Thank you.
It's great. I never could have imagined all the places you guys would bring us today. Yes. Now I'm excited to see where Holly brings us. Holly Guerin, author of River of Bones and the chapbooks River Tracks and Mother's Trails, earned a Massachusetts Cultural Council Award and is a member of the Jamaica Pond Poets. Her work has appeared in journals including Compassion Anthology, Mom Egg Review, Poet Lore, Poetry East, Hawaii Pacific Review, Borderlands, Santa Fe Literary Review, and Worcester Review and Salamander. Holly attends the Joyner Institute for the Study of War and Social Consequence and plays an active role in the Rosie Reads Poetry Series. Holly.
I want to thank Amanda and all of you for being here, and you probably need a little seventh inning stretch at this moment, so, you know, just get up and jump a little, move a little, because three, it's a lot to hear. It's a lot, and what a pleasure to hear Nancy. I just really admire your work. It's just so beautiful. And of course, Wendy and I've read before, so I know your work. And the Gloucester Center is really a lovely place. Henry and Amanda doing a good job here with this. And again, I wonder what I did with my... Oh, well. Here we go. So I'm going to read from this book called Twilight Chorus. It's my new book. It came out in this year. So I'm just going to read from this. I won't, you know, move around to other books or other new poems or anything, just this one. So I'm going to start with the first poem in the book. Can you all hear me okay? Yeah, good. It's called Find the Children, and it's really a response to the refugee situation in the world right now, which is so disturbing. Ease the children down, hungry and cold. Bring quilts to cover them. Bring hot broth. Spoon it into their small moon mouths. Be careful. Blow gently on each spoonful. Around the children are crumbled walls. Around the children are men holed up with weapons. Around the children are too many demons. If the children survive, the demons will ghost their dreams, gallop and crash through their nightmares. If the children survive, they will join those who destroy, or find a way to bring solace. Normal. My mother went to normal school, and that was teacher's college back in the day. But this doesn't have anything to do with normal school, actually. But it's called normal, and it has to do with school and children again. One red brick schoolhouse in Green Bay claims 46 homeless children attending or meaning to daily. The teacher tries. Your lives are no less than the others, offering slices of normal on little plates. The children turn toward her, many not sure where they'll sleep tonight, or they'll be where it's too crowded, cold, too far from friends, noisy for homework, so many paper plates. One boy in a classroom reads out his numbers correctly. He's been having special help and right now has a home, but his mother's laid off again. The apartment won't last. Evening in the kitchen, he's setting white plates carefully on the table, trying hard not to break. I had the pleasure a couple years ago of having dinner with some veterans that were back from a retreat they had been on. And so this poem came out of that experience. Supper at Galway House. This is in Jamaica Plain, this place, this restaurant. I sit with men fresh from retreat where the bones crescendo can deafen, where relief sputters in the listening, the telling. Three sit pushed against the back wall. Next to me, you say, we like to see the whole room across to the bar, that door where anyone can enter. You tell me how you've hidden yourself in a small apartment, barely leaving except for the necessities, how you almost remarried, but walked away. Now you emerge a prayer plant opening to sun, folding later in the day. Dreams are no place you want to go, where fingers and limbs fly and eyes stare into you. But here, you are shooting the breeze as we all drink the wine, the beer, just for now, quenching our thirst. Okay. I worked at Roxbury Community College for many years, about 25 years, actually. And this student, Ralph, would come in and see me occasionally, and this is a poem for him. It's called How High the Sky. Isn't the sky getting taller? I turned toward the window, craned my neck. Ralph, I think the sky is in about the same place. Now I have to wonder, what place was that? Is that? As if I knew. Back then, I thought Ralph needed grounding. His mind could be a minefield of scatter with a voice leading him to streets on the Fenway naked. I was hoping it wasn't the start of his voices. His fantasy to watch the sky heighten and grow like a beanstalk could terrify a mind like mine that didn't comprehend a place without borders. I remember the jigsaw puzzle, fingering each state, their names all contained inside a wooden frame. Now the deepening sky moves with grace beyond borders. Ralph, where are you now? I have a grandnephew I think you say great-nephew or grand-nephew. I'm not really sure, but it's one of the two of those. And he's a skateboarder. So this poem, I saw him in this film where they do this very dangerous stuff. So I wrote this poem. I looked up a lot of the skateboard, you know, terms. And this is called Skateboarders for Jordan Maxim. They travel the globe to glide, to ollie and kickflip, then land flat-bottom or carve the concave ball. Rail slides on a double set, an amazing trick, skating the railings down steep stairs, two flights. No helmets, no pads, only the motto. We don't need language, we have skateboarding. Their rugged heartbeats drum the pavement. In Barcelona, they pause, smoke Cuban cigars. In China, the guards, dismayed by fans, chase. In Dubai, atop Bur Al Arab's helipad, they skate the sky. The gang, we are blood. Believe in the trick and the tweak for one better. They rise from each slam after the burly, breaking the board or slinging it to land where youth's luck shines and they keep flying. Okay. Company of Soldiers. Baghdad, November 2004. Inside Humvees, they ride like strangers from a distant planet, targets for whatever weapons aimed in their direction, alert for any vehicle that sidles up, fearing a driver about to sacrifice for Allah. Trying to do right, called on for minute-by-minute courage, this fabric made by people who never touched the strands of fiber, never tapped the ingredients of dye that yield these colors, tans, the reddish tints of sunset and blood on sand. One buddy was killed. The others hold a ceremony. I am glad to see their tears, men crying with little shame, their close ties woven as they walk on a swaying net stretched over desert. Several years ago, these women were kept captured in a house, and they eventually did get out of it. But this poem was written in there to respect them, and I think of it, too, as I think about Dr. Ford right now and what she's going through. The Time of Tulips. Whatever drank the rain rises and brightens, ambrosia of cups, pink, red, and oh, the variegated ones, pale yellow bleeding into crimson. The chimney hosts a mockingbird, improvising sound. Branches of crabapple lean toward me, praising what has opened them into a passion of fuchsia. And still, daily, the reminders. The world's shadow on the morning paper, today this, rebuttal. Rescue, lost girls found. They have become women, 10 years locked in the shabby house, finally kicking their way out. Now they join the blooming. Somehow they too breathe. I really worry about the bees, because we need the bees, and they're not in a very strong place right now. So this is called the Bees' Lament. They fuss when I pull weeds, the ones they know will flower, and they know I'm taking nectar they need, and what do I want with their food? Haven't human hands done enough? Haven't you dug enough on our earth, you invaders? Haven't you taken what was whole and broken it? It's true, you have also made cranes to pull the concrete into place and paintings to record your faces. Your inventions never stop. Yes, you have something we do not. But we are the ones who gather and move pollen from bud to bud and don't even see what follows. We die before the fruit grows plump. Without us, your foods will never grow, will never go beyond blossom. And this one is called Buddha. I met him yesterday, his hat knit inspiring colors, spiraling colors. When he saw us, he led his mother across the street, he no bigger than the object of his eyes' quest, my small dog, Ginger. I paused to welcome his arrival as he stepped up the curb. New to walking upright, he did not hesitate and reached out with tiny hands seeking the best place to touch. Ginger was willing, didn't move away, and began giving him her friendship licks. On his round face, a look of joy, contagious, really, as Ginger chose this moment to bend and lick the pile of snow at our feet. Buddha, right beside her, squatted easily and leaned with open mouth, his young tongue ready to follow. So I'll have trouble with time because I had time in my reading and now I have no idea. So I will just tell me when I'm up to 20 minutes, will you? Thank you. Okay. I'm going to read this one. This was for my son when he was going through a rough patch and he was getting divorced. It's called Getty Square Opera. As though my son were pressing the bar. This is of a revolving door, you know, that you go into, and heard that swishing sound, chorus, the revolving door, my arms hold you, as though he doesn't enter or take his chances outside, where several roads converge down, chorus, the city square, streets angle down and down, where bus stops proliferate, I'm waiting at one, on my way home from the hospital, nurse's aide for the summer, opposite Woolworth's. Chorus, the time of youth. I lift the bedpans from under them, offer back rubs, inhale their urine. The nurses teach me to fold tight corners. But I wouldn't bathe that boy my age, 16. The nurses were amused or didn't want the work. Chorus, the too young mother. I'm silent. Let the song continue. My embarrassment crept down, tingled. Didn't know what lay ahead would grow, unborn son, unwitting fruit. Did that boy fall asleep, covered in dry sweat? Chorus, the time of bathing. I soap the washcloth, move it over his body, rinse it in the basin of water. Next poem is for a friend who, when I wrote this poem, was very healthy and right now is very ill. So I dedicated to her, and it's calling. You call to tell me a friend in Zimapan, this is in Mexico, a young man lived at home. He was epileptic, just, oh, tragic, shot himself. Oh, why, the sweetest one, you loved him. Before he did, oh, this tragic, you say the word again to let it spread. Ointment, no, it can't. On shattered flesh at 3 a.m., I feel so lonely. Called his mother, please come. She did, but not soon enough. To his father, too, said those words we've all said or meant to. How was it just then, or was there a long time before, we won't hear, he found himself so without in Zimapan, high in the mountains? You and I were there. The bus climbed craggy roads, winding. We often call each other when we feel and not exactly say alone and talk not of that, but of other ways the engines of our lives stall and seem to stop. Yet mercifully, go on humming. Okay. I'm going to move now to the last part of the book. I think probably a couple more, right? A couple more? Sounds right? Okay, let me see where we want to go here. Wonderland. I want to go to Wonderland here. We need to get a little lighter. Wonderland. Okay, out now, all those maple seedlings are falling down, right? They're all over the ground. I mean, I don't know if you have maple trees in your yards, but our neighbors have lots of maple trees, so we get lots of maple seedlings. Wonderland. Falling now, green maple wings, we'd separate and let the sticky part cling to our noses, like liking the foolish look. Now I'm the foolish grown-up, swinging my five-gallon bucket, gathering the acorns, hard olive and shelled toadstill brown. And those relentless roses of Sharon, whose floral castings open and deposit tiny whites, bound to sprout thousands of hopefuls. Soon they'll rush to bury themselves. Meanwhile, above my head, the wide blooms wave, dropping spent blossoms, and I'm on a mission, like Alice, moving beneath them, not sure of what my purpose was. And I'll read one more, and it's the title poem of the book. Or maybe I'll read two more, because I want to read Blue Sky. Two more, okay. Blue Sky. This is the garden again. I seem to get drawn into the garden, and once I get drawn into the garden, Phil has to call me to come back in the house and cook, because I sort of forget about everything else that needs to be done inside. It's so nice to be outdoors. Blue sky. What to do with a blue sky that draws me out to dig where dirt creeps under my nails, to bend, to squat, to grab the hose and bathe what's new, and realize the hardy geranium, despite my tending, may not grow. There will be other varieties, perhaps more beautiful, although that struggler sticks in my mind. My friend called to say her husband's returned to hospital. The tumor makes it hard for him to breathe. Here the garden's white and yellow blooms, its magenta, its sheet of green, all exhale without effort. And the blue sky's a magnet that pulls me toward what my hands attempt to do. And then I'll read the last one, which is the title poem called Twilight Passage. Twilight Chorus, sorry. Looking at the wrong one here. Twilight Chorus. We are all singing in the Twilight Chorus. Listen, you'll hear our voices as the breeze moves through drying leaves. No audition required. You will attend, naked or robed in finery, your umbrella draped over your arm or open to the wind. Even if you schedule an appointment, we'll meet at the horizon where in mauve and wine the sun descends. Even if your plans are traipsing ahead like loyal soldiers in the desert, the chorus patiently awaits your breath. The chorus has a repertoire, fine songs you'll quickly learn. They have been rehearsed and sent down. Thank you.